Okay, good afternoon, everyone. If you feel any drops on your head, it's probably there are a few leaks around in the ceiling, so there was one just there, so don't panic if you feel something land on your head. Paul Wilson is unfortunately away today, and so he asked if I would do the introductions for Colin's talk this afternoon. So it's a real great pleasure to introduce Colin. Colin has just told me he's been here now 39 years in September, I think, is that correct, at Sutton Bonington. So, and I was just asking, having a conversation about numbers of PhD students, and Colin's supervised around 35 or so PhD students, many of whom have been working in the area of agroforestry, or in tropical intercropping in the semi-arid tropics. So it gives me really great pleasure to introduce Colin's talk this afternoon on agroforestry in the semi-arid and sub-humid tropics. Okay,
thanks, Martin. It's a bit like being in the tropics at the moment here. We've got the English monsoon, the roof is leaking, there's water everywhere. As Martin said, I've been here 39 years. A bit more by the time I retire at the end of the year. The only person who has been among the academic staff here for longer is probably Jim, because he came in 1973. And there's an interesting story about Jim, because he and I were at secondary school together in Forfar, which was a town just north of Dundee. He remembers me, I don't remember him. I was the year above, and he always says the year above, don't care about those below. Anyway, I'm going to take you off for 30 or 40 minutes to areas that are a bit warmer and sunnier than it is here in the UK. Projection facilities are not ideal in this room, so some of the slides may be a little bit dark. I'm going to be talking about various aspects of agroforestry, which I'll define in a moment, in the semi-arid and some humid tropics. Now here we've got two examples of plantation crops in Malaysia, and a good example of a typical agroforestry system in Burundi in eastern Africa. Agroforestry involves growing mixtures of different species together. So on the ground here, not very distinct, are beans, French beans being grown as a food crop. In between are rows of bananas, but not bananas as we would know them from Sainsbury's or Tesco, because these are really more plantain type things. They don't quite turn yellow and become sweet and you would eat as a fruit. Instead, they are cooked as a source of carbohydrate. And then beside this farmer there is a woody perennial species, which is silvery oak, which is native to Australia and has been introduced into many parts of eastern Africa. And it's widely regarded as a valuable crop in terms of producing timber and economic value, because it grows fast and it provides very good quality timber for the manufacture of furniture and buildings, flooring, etc. Now, what do I mean by agroforestry? Here's the first glitch. A definition: agroforestry is a land use system in which trees or shrubs, in other words, woody perennials, are grown with crops or pasture species and or livestock in a spatial arrangement, a rotation, or a combination of both. And what do I mean by these two terms there? This is a spatial arrangement on the right-hand side where you've got three different species growing on the same area of land. The woody perennials, the banana and the silvery oak, are there for many years, and the annual crops are grown during the rainy season. And there might, depending on the environment, be one or two rainy seasons, and therefore one or two annual crops each year. So that's a spatial arrangement where the crops are present at the same point in time. A rotation is where you grow them alternately. And one of the major limitations for agriculture in developing countries is poor soil fertility. Not just water, but a shortage of nitrogen and other major nutrients needed for plant growth. And if you can't afford to apply fertiliser to apply to your land, then the fertility is going to fall over time. And after 3 or 4 years, perhaps, of growing annual crops, it's not worth planting them anymore because you're not going to get any decent yield. So at that point in time, the land may be allowed to become what is called fallow. And that could be unimproved fallow, where you just leave it there. And what I would seeds are driven in the ground will grow and establish, and over a period of time will help to improve soil fertility and soil structure. Alternatively, they may be improved farmers who may deliberately plant certain types of species, usually legumes, which are able to capture nitrogen from the soil environment and convert it into chemical nitrogen to help feed the plants and improve the fertility of the soil. And what's the rationale for agroforestry? The various points we're looking at the left-hand side at a copy-based agroforestry system in Embu in Kenya, near Mount Kenya. And coffee is obviously an important cash crop, but it's a plant species that doesn't particularly like full sunlight. And so very often there are scattered what are called overstory trees, trees that are much taller than the coffee and provide with partial shade. Here are bananas in the foreground, and underneath those bananas will be grown annual crops during the rainy season. So it's a multi-strata, multi-purpose system, and the object is to increase productivity by making better use of the natural resources like light, water and nutrients. Because you're mixtures of plants, they capture and utilise more of those available resources. And they also help to mimic ecosystem functions, for example, by the soil conservation, I'll say more about that in a little while. Carbon sequestration, and that is an important issue at the moment because our atmospheric CO2 concentrations have increased considerably since the Industrial Revolution and are still increasing because we're burning fossil fuels, we're clearing forests and so on. So carbon sequestration to reduce the rise in atmospheric CO2 and the associated climate change is vitally important. And also trees can help to generate income by producing high volume products. Those could be coffee, but they could also be fruit or nut trees. Macadamia nuts are one of the most valuable crops grown in the tropics. There are many objectives, a whole range of different products could be grown and produced from the system. Timber for housing and furniture, timber for farming and charcoal, fodder for livestock, we'll say a little more about that later. Enclosures for livestock, and here in Kenya or South Africa or wherever, those enclosures may be important because you've got big game, you've got lions, you've got cheetahs or whatever, and if you don't protect your livestock, your cattle, your goats, they will be predated. And so, timber species, or even cacti, spiny cacti, are often used to provide enclosures into which the animals are taken at night to protect them from the big cats. Green manure, I mentioned a moment ago, that in many developing countries, agriculture is very hand-to-mouth, it's subsistence. People don't have much money, they've got to grow whatever they need. They can't afford to buy inorganic fertilisers, but if they can produce green manure that they can add back to the soil, it helps to improve and maintain fertility and soil structure. And then there may be a range of food products, for example, macadamia nuts, which I mentioned, mangoes, nectarines, or apples. And some of these would be consumed on farm. Some would be taken to for sale in nearby villages or cities. Some would be exported internationally. Decorative and medicinal products, for example, that species there, it's a member of the apple family, Prunus africana, until recently was the only known treatment for prostate cancer. Erosion control, avoidance of loss of soil and sloping land, I'll talk about later. And eco-sanitation is where you're using plants to help clean up land, prevent it becoming contaminated by human or animal waste. Introduction of high volume trees is extremely important. The native species or cultivars that are used are often not very productive and even unpalatable in terms of the quality of the fruit, texture of the fruit that are produced. If you can introduce high volume species, here's one, Caliandra, which is a legume, that provides fodder that is extremely good for feeding livestock. Livestock is important within the local agricultural system because it's a source of food, milk, and also traction. They don't have tractors, they don't have big lorries or whatever. The tilling of the land, the harvesting of material, and the transport of that back to the homestead or to villages is done by animals, by cattle. animals, whatever it happens to be. If you've got a tractor, as a farmer in a rich western country, you're not consuming fuel when you turn off the engine of that tractor or the combine harvester. But your livestock, if you're a subsistence farmer, have got to be fed 365 days a year. If you've got a drought-prone environment with long dry periods that last many months, then it can be very difficult to get enough fodder to feed your livestock. If you can plant and prune trees, you've then got a year-round supply of nutritious food for those livestock. Also, in a couple of examples of improved fruit trees here, improved apples and apple mangoes. Now, the native wild type varieties that grow and are very resistant to harsh conditions, they grow slowly. It may take native mangoes 10, 15 years before they begin to produce fruit, and those fruit are very large stones and they're extremely fibrous, so they're not particularly palatable. You can try to improve or introduce improved western varieties, but they don't have the native tolerance to resist the poor soils, the lack of water, the infertile conditions, the high temperatures and so on. They would die. But one way around that particular problem is that you can cut back the native mangoes, leaving just the rootstock in the ground, and graft onto that the shoots of improved varieties. And that remaining wild-type rootstock provides resistance to the harsh local conditions, while the shoots that have been grafted on are producing high-quality fruit from a much earlier stage. They will begin to produce fruit after maybe 2 or 3 years, and we can see loads and loads of apple mangoes in a much more compact tree than the wild-type. And the same here with the apples. We're now moving a little bit. We've been talking about Africa until now. We're now moving to Java, and a particular province in Java called Batu. On the left-hand side is the traditional system that brought the mixture of banana, maize, and coffee. The coffee was the cash crop. Banana and maize were the fruit crops that helped to support the global population. But there's global overproduction of coffee, and it's really only the best quality coffee that is making money. And so for that reason, the traditional farming systems in parts of the world are changing from this sort of system, in this case the Java, to permanent apple cultivation with year-round production. Now, if you've got a garden, if you've got an apple tree, a plum tree, whatever, you know it's deciduous. It loses its leaves during winter, it becomes dormant, and then the following spring, the gradual increase in the day length and temperature promotes it to produce new leaves, to flower, and then to fruit. In developing countries like Java, you don't have the same seasonality in terms of temperature and day length. And so normally, the apples or other fruit trees wouldn't get the signal that told them winter was coming on. It was time to lose the leaves. Then the spring is approaching, time to produce a new set of leaves, flower, and produce fruit. But you can fool apple trees or other fruit trees into thinking about a winter, because 1 month you can defoliate, let's say 10% of your trees, manually just dropping the leaves to the ground. That makes them think they've had a winter because they've lost their leaves, and they will then produce a new set of leaves, flower, and fruit. Next month you do the same thing. Next month you do the same thing. So you're introducing year-round production of fruit. And here is a grading of apples in Batu. You can see that they've been sorted out into different baskets with apples of different size. It's a simple management system to produce year-round production. The suitable environments are much lower altitudes than in Africa. Chilling's not necessary because you're giving lambing treatment that makes them think that they have winter. And there's a plentiful supply of the wild apple rootstock, which can be used throughout Asia. So again, it's a case of grafting improved shoots onto wild-type rootstock. Now, waterborne erosion, next topic I want to touch on. This is the first step in erosion, and it's a drop of rain falling on a saturated surface. And if you get enough rain over a period of time, you then won't be able to infiltrate into the soil, and you get runoff through a bit of this incoming gradient to the soil surface. And that carries solar with it. And if that process is repeated, then you will get, not very clear, so if it's too much light, but you will get gully erosion. And then eventually, if the process is sustained over a period of years, you'll get complete degradation of the landscape. And once it reaches that sort of state, it's never going to recover. Not even in 100 years or 1,000 years. It was so severely degraded. Erosion and a process called eutrophication is important in developing countries. I think erosion is probably fairly self-explanatory as to what it is. But eutrophication is where nutrients carried off with the eroded soil into watercourses increases the fertility of those watercourses and introduces the surplus growth of plants of various types. In the UK, these might be algae, causing algal grooms in freshwater bodies during the summer period when it's hot. In other cases, it might be higher plants, flowering plants. And this is a very good example. Here we're looking at Lake Victoria, which is bounded on the east by Kenya, on the west, over here out of picture, by Uganda, and to the south by Tanzania. This is all mountainous up here. The population growth in Kenya is among the highest in the world. It's about 3% a year. I've got more mouse to feed, we've got to grow more food, and we've got to grow more timber to support the needs of that increasing population. And so over the years, in recent times, the mountainous areas up here have been largely cleared of the natural forest to provide land for agriculture. And as soon as you remove the forest, you're exposing the soil to runoff of water, rainfall, downhill, and that will carry with it the fertile topsoil, and so you get erosion. The area, the red areas here, represent areas of high population density, high forest blooms, high agricultural activity, and high erosion. And that water containing soil gets carried off into watercourses, into rivers, and into Lake Victoria. And here, at the southern end of Lake Victoria, you can see a sort of greyish cloud in the water. And that is suspended silt that was once fertile agricultural land in the mountains surrounding Lake Victoria. And the picture on the left is a computer-enhanced view of this area here. And the blue area is the area of highest silt near the mouth of the river. Grey, the red, green rather. Next highest concentration of silt, then red, and then the natural background level there. Now that creates two different kinds of problem. First, the farmers in these land areas are losing the fertile soil they need to grow their crops. Secondly, it's getting deposited into the Victoria and it's taking with it fertility and other nutrients that used to be in the soil in the terrestrial environment. And the result of that was a bloom not of algae, but of something called water hyacinth. And that formed a really intense mat over the surface of the water that was so dense that it actually prevented fishermen from getting their boats out from the shore into Lake Victoria to capture fish for food and for export to high-quality restaurants in the capital cities of Europe. There is another important problem. Here in Tanzania, big Australian companies are mining gold and they use cyanide to help extract the gold from the ore. And the wastewater is supposedly held in reservoirs, but quite often these overflow or the main break. And the water that was contained in them, containing cyanide, gets carried off into Lake Victoria. And it got to the point where the fish, the certain type called tilapia, a variety of perch, became so contaminated by cyanide that they could no longer be exported to market in Europe because they exceeded European safety standards. Okay, erosion. This is a very nice example of erosion in a watershed in southwest Uganda. There was a very heavy El Nino event in the early 2000s, and you can just about probably see where water and soil flowed downhill. And then when the gradient of the land leveled out, it was then deposited, so you've got soil that has come from uphill, has been laid down at the bottom of that hill slope, and it's in these little valley, the village at the bottom of that slope. And you can see the high tide mark there, where the soil rose to the top of the doorways and the windows within those houses. There were about 21 villagers out of 120 plus killed in that single event. So you've got two problems. Firstly, there's a hazard. It's the villagers living in the valley at the bottom. But equally, those villagers depend on the hill slopes around about them to grow food in order to survive. You can't have that happening for too long because there's no source of food to support the local population. So the community, they called in an organisation which is called the International Centre for Research in Agroforestry, which is headquartered in Nairobi, but works throughout the tropics, and said, can you help? Can you help us conserve the soil on our hill slopes that we depend on to grow our food? And Edgar said, yeah, we'll give you the advice. And most of the people in the picture are local villagers in the Sunday Best, but some of them, like that person there, that one there, are scientific experts from ICRAF headquarters. They said, we'll give you the material, we'll give you training, you've got to do the work. And that hill slope that we looked at a little bit earlier was farmed by about 80 or 90 different farmers, not all of whom lived in the village at the bottom, some of them came from kilometres away. So you had to convince the entire population, the entire community, to participate in this activity. Because there's no point in people near the bottom of the hill taking measures to reduce erosion if people at the top of the hillside are not doing it. Something that also is quite important is that concrete tank now. Rain in semi-arid areas is not really very different from what it is here in the UK. Here the sun only is moving at something like 650 millimetres a year. In semi-arid environments, they get the same amount of water and might even get more. But the problem is, it's highly seasonal. You may only have one rainy season, which might be 2 or 3 or 4 months in length. You might be two. But you've got long dry periods where the water evaporates away, and if you've got slow demand, it runs away. So there's a problem in terms of having sufficient supplies of clean water for cooking, for washing, etc. There is plenty of water. Easy way to capture it is to build tanks. Cook better around the rooms of the building and channel during the rainy seasons the water into these storage tanks. There has been problems in many of these communities that female children particularly were losing a lot of education because they suffered from dysentery, diarrhea. They weren't able to wash appropriately to be able to go to school. If you can provide that sort of storage reserve, then you've got clean water for use throughout the year. So, ICRAF came in, they brought material from seeds of cuttings and so on for woody perennial species, and they provided training to local villagers into how to propagate these, how to build up populations of tree saplings that could be planted out on hill slopes to stabilise them. This is a woman who was trained to run a tree nursery, and she then trained other women in the vicinity to do the same thing. That's the village headman, and he helped to disseminate the information and the material as well. And the headman took me and my wife up to the watershed that we saw earlier where the major erosion had occurred. That was the photograph that was taken just after they started to plant trees along the contours to provide a physical barrier to reduce runoff and therefore the loss of soil. That was just after the process started. This was when we went and visited and stood here, and the headman said to me that it brought tears to his eyes when he came and looked here, because he could remember how bad it was and how good it now was. Having stabilised the land, you may get some additional benefits as well, because if you plant trees, especially if they are nitrogen fixing, you've got a continuous supply of fodder for livestock. So you can bring in improved livestock. This is called stall fed. In other words, here in the UK, we might put out our cattle into fields to graze. There, they're taking material from the trees that we planted locally and bringing it to these cattle or other animals that are kept within stalls. Nothing goes to waste. Everything that comes out of the rear end of that cow or whatever is harvested and used to fertilise the plots of which vegetables and other crops have been grown. Another important point is that the diet in much of Africa is very about 60% of the calories come from maize alone. There's a shortage of protein. If you've got a supply of water and you plant trees, you can then put in fish ponds and you can grow fish to improve the supply of protein within the local diet. Okay, I want to move on to something completely different, to bamboo. Bamboo is potentially a very important group of species, there are about 1,300 of them in the world, for producing food and various other commodities, which we'll see in just a moment. You may think of bamboo as a little spindle of the cane that you go into Tesco or into B&Q to buy to support your house plants and stop them falling over, to grow the weight and get a bit of water stress. But bamboo can be enormous, and it can be used for a whole range of different uses, furniture, construction, flavouring for beer and wine, production of medicines, floorboard and laminated bamboo products, food and handcraft materials, and so the food. Here we've got a range of different things being shown there. There's beer in China that has been flavoured using bamboo leaves, shown up there. This is bamboo shoot production, and these are a range of bamboo fruit products that are produced. And the economic value of these can be absolutely enormous in global terms. So, for example, in a single province in China, bamboo shoot processing is mainly for export to Shanghai and Japan. There are 120 factories in that one rural province alone. It's the bamboo shoot is the most lucrative bamboo product, producing income of perhaps US $2,000 for a farmer per year. $2,000 may not sound a great deal to us in the UK, but in China, that is a lot of money. The market for bamboo shoots in that province is worth about $300 million each year. It's also so species is extremely useful for construction. That is a bridge constructed of bamboo. This photograph is looking along the inside of it. And the reason why bamboo is so good is that it grows very rapidly. This is actually giant bamboo, and that will grow to maybe 30 metres in height. The stems will be maybe 15 to 20 centimetres in diameter. And it's got a tensile strength greater than steel. That doesn't sound reasonable. Its strength per unit mass is greater than steel. And part of the reason for this is that individual stems are hollow, but they're cross-braced. You can see little darker areas there, which is where there's a solid disc of tissue crossing the entire stem. So they're light, but they're strong. And they're also flexible, which means that if you're in an earthquake-prone area, then solid buildings made of concrete, steel, or bricks, or whatever, they will tend to crack, fracture, and fall down. Bamboo constructions are flexible. They can shake with the tremors and not fall down. And there are villages in certainly earthquake-prone parts of the world where the houses are entirely constructed from bamboo to protect them against earthquakes. Well, our next one to move on to is how you can add value. You can grow bamboo, you can grow trees, you can sell that one to you. It brings you a certain amount of money. But if you've got skill to manufacture your raw material into furniture, clothing, tourist booths and so on, you can turn maybe $10 of raw material into $100 worth of manufactured produce. I forgot to do it. I meant to put on a bamboo shirt today. Absolutely forgot. Bamboo makes an absolutely fantastic fibre. It's got qualities akin to silk, but it's also biocidal. If you are interested in finding more about it, go to Google, put BAM, and you'll come to the biggest company in the UK distributing bamboo clothing. It wicks. It's very good in terms of breathing, so it's removing sweat from your body and evaporating into the atmosphere. But that fibre is also biocidal. It's got materials in it that stop odours developing. The guy that set up BAM, he used to be a student at Loughborough University, once claimed it made a pair of his own socks for 21 days, bamboo socks, played squash in them, and they still didn't smell at the end of that. And the Chinese also show that you can actually wash bamboo maybe 80 or 90 times in machine washing with detergent, and it still retains biocidal properties. So it's used often for sporting materials, for undergarments, for people undertaking great energy. The basic concept is there that if you can take your raw material and manufacture it into something, you're adding volume to that raw material. And here, bamboo mats and lines being manufactured, a major source of income at village level, 70% of women employed, many managers of cottage industries, and those products are great for export to the small scale industry. And you can see there the last bullet point. There are over 40,000 farmers involved in the process of bamboo in that single Chinese province. Okay, back to raw material. There's some volume in it, not a huge amount of volume. But if you have the skills to be able to transform it into a four-piece dining suite, into floorboards, into sheds or whatever, you're adding volume to that raw product that you grow. Here is charcoal being made from it, a range of different kinds of materials, and clothing made from bamboo. You can even buy ball gowns manufactured from bamboo. Charcoal, this example here in the Chinese province of Xinjiang, produces over 100 different charcoal products, mostly for use in health and medical purposes. Mainly exported to Japan, Korea, US, and Europe, and the output is worth about $12 million a year. I think I'll probably pass over this, and I've lost my microphone by the sound of it. Pass over this fairly quickly. There are about 1,300 species of bamboo. They're actually grasses, but they're woody grasses. So that green material out there, that's a grass. The bamboos we're talking about are grasses, but they're woody. And the global market is worth about US$12 billion. The Chinese share of that is about a quarter. And here there are figures showing how bamboo production is increasing. A column is a name for the stem of the bamboo, and the production of bamboo stems tripled over that 16-year period, and the production of bamboo shoots increased by a factor of about 4.5 times. India has about 45% of the world's bamboo forests. It produces 4.5 million tonnes of bamboo on 9 million hectares of land. But you can see the Chinese are much more efficient because they're producing more than twice as much on half the land area. Here's an important bottom line. Replacing 25% of plywood produced in India by bamboo mat board could save 8,000 hectares of natural forest each year. And it creates a huge amount of work, and the volume of production is also enormous. Now moving to East Africa, and the possible introduction of bamboo species, which are largely endemic to Asia, into African countries to help protect natural forest and produce woody products. Here's a photograph taken of alpine bamboo in the Aberdare Mountains near Mount Kenya in 1927. You get your eye in, you can just about see there are two cars there. These are Henry Ford's Model T cars back in 1927. Gives an idea of scale. These cars might be 2 meters high. There's the height of your alpine bamboo. That bamboo used to extend almost to the centre of current day Nairobi, but over the years it's gradually been cleared to convert land for agriculture or as a source of timber. And so the only areas remaining in Kenya now are on Kenya itself in that blue zone. Our bamboo is important. This simply shows a range of different bamboo types that you can find natural, endemic in Africa. These symbols show where they're distributed within Africa. So quite a lot in Eastern and Southern Africa, a few in West Africa, and one or two in Madagascar. But the African native bamboos are not regarded as being of enormous value. because many of them are quite small. They're weedy. They're more like grasses than proper woody stems. However, many of the Asian bamboos are also suited to be imported into East African countries and can be much better in terms of biomass production. So here we've got giant bamboo growing in Kenya at an altitude of between 1,000 and 2,000 metres above sea level. This is the native bamboo growing higher altitudes, and these are a couple of other examples. And clearly you can see from the scale of the person and the bamboo that they're producing a lot of wood, which can be used for a range of different purposes. Other species have been introduced into East African countries. That's eucalyptus, introduced from Australia, and this is the giant bamboo that we've just been talking about. Both of them are about 10 years old. And initially, eucalyptus was thought to be a great import because it grew really fast, produced lots of timber, and so was well liked. But it's got a major downside, and that is it's extremely greedy for water and nutrients, and it causes soil degradation quite quickly. Whereas the giant bamboo produces the same sort of biomass over the same time scale, but requires less water and nutrients to be able to do it. So it's less damaging to the soil. It can also be used for protecting riverbanks against erosion. You can see from the water there that it's quite murky. There's water being, the soil being eroded from further upstream. But these plantations along the edge of the river help to protect. Now, we've talked about added value several times. The Chinese know how to add value to bamboo. The Africans, until quite recently, didn't have that knowledge. And so here is a workshop being held at Bushcraft's headquarters in Nairobi, where Chinese experts were brought in, also in Ethiopia and other African countries, to provide training in the skills needed to transform the raw material into something that they can then sell and raise money from that raw material. So here you've got furniture, you've got beds, you've got tables, three-piece suite, etc. Now we're getting towards the end. It's not just humans that are interested in bamboo. Here we're looking at a picture of a mountain gorilla in Windy Forest in southern Uganda. There are quite a lot of more mature faces in the audience. You may well remember a film called Gorillas in the Mist, which stars Sigourney Weaver. I don't know, it was made 20, 25 years ago. And that documented the life of an ecologist who was instrumental in preventing the mountain gorillas from being made extinct in Uganda. And she rescued those populations who were at that time being hunted for their fur and also as a source of what is called bushmeat, in other words, wild animals that were harvested to feed people. And she managed to salvage the populations, and as a result, they made a comeback in Rwanda. Rwanda had major civil wars, but now they've settled down considerably. Rwanda, Uganda, and then the Congo. Congo is much more challenging because there's still civil war going on there, and the giant, the mountain gorillas in the north of the Congo are still being hunted. What really came to their to help them survive was the fact that the governments learned that gorillas were a major tourist attraction. And you can now go and climb into the mountains in Rwanda and in Uganda to go and visit the gorillas. They tell you that you should never look a silverback, which is a mature male gorilla, around 30 years old, in the eye, because he will take that as a sign of aggression. But actually, these gorillas have become so habituated that you can get within 2 or 3 metres of these big guys, and the young ones will come bounding up to you to find out what you're all about, just out of sheer interest. That is generating a huge amount of tourist income and is helping to maintain, to improve the populations, at least in Rwanda. Okay, silly photographs at the end. Friend mountain gorilla. We have quite a number of environmental biology students within the school, and quite often they go and they do projects in developing countries, for example, looking at orangutan conservation in Borneo. There was another student who went to look at marine conservation, coral reef conservation in a remote island in Fiji. Basically, they were doing lectures during the morning in aspects of marine biology, and then they were scuba diving in the afternoon to survey the reef. And the reefs were being damaged by human activity in two different ways. Firstly, invasive fishing, where the fishermen were chucking dynamite into the atoll to stun the fish in order to harvest them. And secondly, because of increasing populations, there was forest clearance, there was runoff, there was deposition of silt onto the coral reefs. What they were trying to do was to gain enough information about the richness, the biodiversity of these corals to get them made into a World Heritage Site. And another student went to Panama a few years ago to look at predation of turtles as they came ashore to lay their eggs by jaguars from the forest at the top of the beach. And she had two areas, one of which was fenced off to stop the jaguars getting onto the beach, and the other was not fenced. And basically she and her team were looking at the severity of predation in the two different areas. These students gave them those experiences. So this is a group of students who graduated this year in environmental biology. They graduated up at University Park, they then went back here for a prize-giving ceremony and also a reception. So it's nice to see so many happy faces and to be able to say that most of them have gone on to jobs immediately after getting their degree. So this girl, very first, she's gone to work with Shell in Aberdeen. That one has been offered a job with the National Nature Conservancy at one of the nature reserves in Norfolk. She's got a job with ADAS. He's going on to study a master's degree in biological photography and imaging. She's been teacher training, and this one's going to keep her feet up for a while to earn some money and pay back some of her debt. So, final slide. And that's it, I think. Any questions?
Sorry about the sound effects from the teacher.
I just ignored it.
Does anybody have any questions for Colin?
Stunned silence.
I actually missed the part where you were talking about staring a silverback in the eye. What was the?
Silverback is a name given to mature male gorillas, and they tend to be at least 20 years old, maybe 30 years old, and they take it as a sign of aggression if you look them in the eye. And so that encourages or increases the risk that you may be attacked by them. But these people see so many tourists, they don't appear to be disturbed by it, that they are habituated. They're happy for people to come fairly close to them. They don't want to go up with that one, and they never mind. And that's to say, the young ones will come right up to you to find out what you're about. And I should also have said, I didn't say it, that bamboo is really important for these giant mountain gorillas, because it's their main source of food and certainly the main habitat. And so if that alpine bamboo disappears, their livelihood disappears with it. And there was a major problem happening in Uganda, in Rwanda, where local villagers were encroaching onto the alpine bamboo forest because they need timber for various purposes, for building, for construction, making charcoal, etc. And so the habitat for the gorillas was going down. How do you resolve that? You want to preserve the gorillas, but the local population, which is expanding, also needs a supply of timber for various purposes. One solution that has been suggested and is being tried is that there is a species of bamboo called yellow bamboo, which accumulates cyanide, and nothing will eat it. The cyanide is locked in there, and until that bamboo breaks down, decomposes, the cyanide is locked away. Plant a ring of yellow bamboo round the outskirts of the forest, and that will provide a supply of timber for various purposes for the surrounding villagers, but the gorillas won't go into it because it's toxic as they eat it. So they still have their habitat preserved, and there is the additional bamboo around the outskirts. Another lovely example of this is in the Aberdeer Mountains in near Mount Kenya. It's a cloud forest with very high rainfall, something like 3.5 metres of rain a year, and it's incredibly biodiverse in terms of its flora and its fauna. It's got huge populations of elephants and so on. Now, elephants and local farmers don't really get on very well, because the elephants tend to come out of the forest and go and savage the farmer's maize or their avocados or whatever. So the farmers get naturally a little bit ratty about that, and so they tend to kill the elephants. There was a British person who probably is no longer alive, because at the time we met him, he was already of advanced years, and he managed to raise the money to construct a fence that was about 300 kilometres long to keep the animals in and the farmers out round about the forest. And he built a hotel that was called the Ark, because it was shaped like Noah's Ark. And the pointed end of it overlooked a waterhole, and we had been driven up into the forest by a minibus or something, a 2 or 3 hour trip, and saw so much in terms of wildlife. It was just amazing. But when we got there, dusk was falling, and the elephants were coming in from the jungle to the waterhole to drink. And the noise of these 50 to 100 elephants coming out of the forest, trumpeting, was just amazing. In your rooms, you had an intercom, which you could switch off. And basically, overnight, people would be keeping an eye on the waterhole, and then they would call you as soon as anything interesting appeared. And a lot of these safari hotels are actually built close to waterholes, so you don't actually need to go out to find the animals. They come to you. And at different times of day, you've got different types of animals coming in to drink.
Yeah, John.
You were talking quite a lot about repairing and rectifying issues with erosion, etc., for mountain trees and agroforestry. Are there areas in the world where pristine rainforest or natural environment is being destroyed to create agroforestry plantations?
Yeah. I mean, this is a big problem in Malaysia, Indonesia, parts of Southeast Asia, where the natural forest has been cleared to convert the land for oil palm production. The oil palm itself can become part of an agroforestry system, because you can have the annual crops growing under the oil palm. But the pressure for income, increasing populations, is causing major difficulties. But I've talked mainly about the tropics, but there are some fascinating systems still in Europe, Northern Europe, extending across into Poland and the former Soviet Union. There are also a series of forests of cork oak, which are called dehesas, in Spain, Portugal, other parts of the Mediterranean. And these were grown originally to provide cork material for stopping wine bottles and other types of alcoholic, bottle, and also for making cork flooring and the like. The current trend is that bottles increasingly are being sealed by metal screw top seals to save money, or by plastic corks rather than real cork. Part of the problem was that if you weren't using top quality cork, it could breathe too much, and the wine would sour within the bottle. So that's part of the reason why there's been a decline in using cork seals in bottles of wine and other forms of alcohol. Now, this is a major knock-on effect, because these dehesas are incredibly biodiverse. They are cork oak trees, which have got lots of wildflowers underneath them. Annual food crops may be grown underneath as well. At the right time of year, pigs are introduced into the dehesas for fattening, because the acorns are falling off the oak trees, they're rich in oils, and they're great for fattening pigs for the production of materials equivalent to Parma ham. Because there is a decline in the demand for cork, there is less incentive to manage the dehesas. They tend to be falling into disuse or even cleared. Ecologically, that has a vast impact because I think it's cranes migrate during winter from the Arctic down into the dehesas to overwinter and then return again several thousand kilometres back to the Arctic to breed again the following summer. As these dehesas disappear, fall into disuse, that migratory process is likely to be affected.
Any more questions? Okay, so can we just thank Colin once again for a really interesting talk.